The last time that I dove into a study of the book of Daniel with the church was our church, and it was stopped by the pandemic. We were going through Daniel, and I got all the way to almost to chapter 7. In fact, we had just bought our ticket to the zoo, and we received notice that we had to close down that week. And of course, you know, we closed twice, and by the time that we came back again, I thought that it was pretty futile to try to pick up a study that we had begun like 90 days before, especially one like Daniel. But I remember the first time that I ever took a church through the book of Daniel, and I was all the way through chapter 10. So I was at the same point that we were 2 weeks ago before communion. And then what happened was that we had communion just like we did last week. And I poured over chapter 11 after communion. I studied. I opened up commentaries. I was looking for just about everything that I could because chapter 11 was so difficult. It was so different than what had come before. And of course, we had had a week off from Daniel, and I just gave up by Wednesday and changed to a new series. And guess what? No one in the church noticed. They were happy, actually, that we did not try to venture into 11 and 12, because 11 and 12, these two chapters that we have left, we kind of lose interest because we lose our interest in it. You know what I mean? In that we always use Daniel in an evangelistic series kind of way. And by the time that we're done with 10, we're kind of done with the evangelistic bent, that you will, that we should exist, that we have the secrets of the book of Daniel, and then we just kind of move on, which is why normally when we then go through the series, 11 and 12 just kind of hang out there. We just kind of wander away. Well, I stuck with it, and I don't know if I should apologize to you ahead of time, because sticking with it is not easy. The problem with just moving on is that it leaves then chapter 11 and 12 to a particular group of prophecy hobbyists. You ever met somebody whose hobby is prophecy? You ever been entertained by a chart that is as long as your living room wall, to where everything is plugged in? Well, we may complain about those, but the reason that those people exist is that we give them fuel and fodder, because we walk away from chapters like 11 and we just say, hey, well, you know, go ahead. And they don't have any rules. At least we've got rules, right? We knew where we came from. We know the rules Daniel has established for you. If you've studied through Daniel to this point, we know the rules. We know exactly where we are in historic and prophetic timeline, don't we? Because 8 has told us, and 9 has told us, and 10 has told us. All of it has told us. It puts us in a particular place. And we really need it, because chapter 11, it changes.
Symbology that Daniel uses changes completely as to where we are in the timeline. It becomes more difficult to get through because it bounces around like a ping pong ball. The conflicts go back and forth. World wars just bounce off each other.
And we're left completely, almost completely unmoored if we don't remember where we came from. So the book has brought us here with clear guidelines and clues for interpretation. So I'm going to try to stay with those. We have to stay with those. If not, then we might as well just move on, because chapter 11 is ridiculous if it doesn't have any good hermeneutical rules. Just ridiculous. So just to remember something that went way back before we even got to the zoo, back in the narratives of the book of Daniel, back to meeting Nebuchadnezzar and these four youth meeting Nebuchadnezzar, and we decided that Babylon represented a system of worship. And the system of worship of Babylon is based on power, and the power isn't necessarily from God. There's an element of religious power inside of it, but the power that it is used to enforce this religious observance is all based on power from below. It's based on the power that the human has. Remember, even the location is in the plain of Shinar, where the actual Tower of Babel was built. And remember, the Tower of Babel was the very first time that humanity tried to usurp God. They were trying to build a tower all the way to heaven to try to take care of this God before he took care of them. And they used all their ingenuity and all the power from below. So Babylon then, in the rest of Scripture, the rest of prophetic and historic timeline, becomes to be known as this particular system of worship. It's manifested in Revelation in two beasts throughout history that have the dragon's power. But everyone mistakes it for who? Everyone mistakes it for God. So it's these two powers that come together. The little horn that Daniel introduces us to in chapter 8, that little horn is a supposed Christian God and a Christian method of worship. But it's actually a mixture of complete, absolute human power from the ashes of the Roman Empire and the ecclesiastical power, if you will, of the Christian church. It's a perversion, Babylon is. It looks good to the world. It may even look good to us because the whole world wonders after the beast. But Daniel represents what he brings from Jerusalem, what he brings from the temple that is built or based on the heavenly sanctuary where the true Christian God formed his own way of worship. That he sent his son, a lamb that was slain, and then used all of our free will by falling in love with us and asking us if he was worthy then to fall in love with him. We all have decision. We all have choice. Worship of the real God is based on freedom. It's based on free will because that's the way we were created. And to me, this is the key to the chapter. And if not, if we don't understand that, if we don't understand these two competing forms of worship, these two competing gods, if you will. Because remember, in the end, it's not the church against the world. The world doesn't necessarily fight against the church. It does sometimes in history. It does, and we'll take a look a little at what chapter 11 says about that. But ultimately, the final battle, the great controversy, is not the church against the world. It's one church competing with another church. It's a true church competing with a false church. It's a church that looks good on the outside, that answers every logical argument, that appeals to the power that humans want, but it's based on fear and force and coercion. That's the church of the beast, the two beasts, fueled by the dragon. And then there's the church of the lamb that was slain. A God who's willing to give up all of himself. A God is willing to give up all the power that he has. Could God use this power for a selfish purpose? Of course he could. He's God, but he decided not to. He decided he'd rule by love. He decided he'd rule by freedom. If we don't remember this going in, then you can truly, truly end up in the weeds in chapter 11. And like I said, my last two times through here, I ended up in the weeds and I gave up. And the last time, like I said, my church didn't even notice that I gave up because they gave up too. They were happy to move on, I guess. So, like I said, I'm not sure if I should apologize to you for what I'm about to attempt. Okay? Or maybe we will get through and in and out of the weeds because I know I'm going to disappoint some of you. I know that I am. Because I don't think this is about being able to key historic events with the battles and the wars and the conflicts that's described in chapter 11. I don't think it's about, I think what we need to take a look at is the language that Daniel uses here compared to what he was using in chapter 10 and chapter 8. You with me? All right, let's give it a shot. Daniel 11:1. In the first year of Darius the Mede, I arose to be an encouragement and a protection for him. Now, this has nothing to do with the prophetic timeline, except that Daniel is letting you know where we are. He is now saying, this is not the future, this is not the past, this is where I am right now. And by the way, it ends, the narratives ended here too, with Darius the Mede. Darius is the king that threw him into where? That threw him into the lion's den. So to me, the amazing thing is that Daniel says, after all this, after the vision that he received in chapter 10, the assurance that God would be there throughout history, no matter what happened in the historic part, no matter what happened on the worldly kingdom side, God's presence in the high priest that showed up in chapter 10 is that he's there, that he's present. I'm going to be with you to the end. And Daniel takes that as encouragement, because the beginning of this chapter, he's not flat on his face, near dead. He's not sick as to what he has seen. He's actually encouraged, and he's decided to go give who encouragement? He's decided to give Darius encouragement. See, he knows that Darius' kingdom is about to fall. He's seen the timeline. He knows what's coming, and he actually goes to encourage him. Imagine that. The guy that threw you into the lion's den, you're actually going to go to his office and encourage him. Doesn't have anything to do with the timeline except to say that it puts us in real time. The chapter now gives us a time that Daniel is speaking from. The first four verses of chapter 11 are about what we already know. We've already been here. He words it a bit differently, but we've already been here. We know where we're going and we know where we are. I'll tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of who? Against the realm of Greece. We know where we are, don't we? The Medo-Persian Empire is getting ready to collapse. By this time, it's on its last four legs, if you will. Maybe two if both of them were co-regents. By the way, Cyrus was Darius's co-regent. They both ruled at the same time. It's on its last legs. We know where we are. We know where it is on the timeline. Why? We saw the statue in chapter 2. Medo-Persia, then who? Then Greece, all right? Silver, bronze, right? Remember? And then in the zoo, it goes from leopard to, no, not leopard, from bear to leopard. We know where we are. At least we know where we are in the timeline. Here is where we are. So the fourth will fight Greece. And the kings lay out historically this way. Cambyses will come after Darius the first, not the Mede. He will come after that, another Darius, Xerxes, or King Ahasuerus in the book of Esther. Okay, this, he will come next and go to 465. And then Artaxerxes will go from 465 to 423. He's the king. He's the one that will throw and put all this into motion. Remember, he is the one. He is the one during his reign when the decree went out to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. During his reign was when we got the timeline, the starting point of the 2300-day prophecy. It all works out right here. And this has pretty much been established, especially in Jewish tradition, all the way back to the 11th century, these four kings to be able to establish this. There are several Greek historians who label Artaxerxes as the shrewdest of his predecessors, rich enough to buy off all his allies, weakening their political strength with him. And like I said, this now reattaches us to Daniel 9. Because Artaxerxes, during his reign, it was his reign, 457, right? That we got the starting point of the 2300-day prophecy. So at least in chapter 11, do we know where we are? We know where we are, don't we? The transition from Medo-Persia to Greece. As we move on, the next part is just as easily recognized as we had seen it back in the other chapters. A mighty king will arise. He will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. And yet, while still rising in power, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven but not to his posterity, nor according to the dominion to which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted and go to others besides these. Who's this great king? Who comes next? Who was the very first king in Greece? The big horn in chapter 8. Alexander the Great. Remember? And at the height of his power, Alexander suddenly dies, and he gives the power over to his four generals. This describes it differently. It says that his power was broken up and scattered to the four winds of heaven. But we know where we are. We know what happened in history. The totality of the empire, what he comes to, is that it's scattered to the wind. This is a complete giving over of the Greek Empire to the Roman Empire. It's an odd phrase. It's a difficult phrase to translate. But it says, not according to the dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted and go to others besides these. He says, this is not about his generals. What's about to come next is not about the kingdoms that arise from the generals, because they go on for another couple hundred years. And it ends up that the southern kingdoms, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, they rule for a bit longer. It's the Ptolemies and Seleucids that Rome takes away. But actually what the prophecy says is that when the Greek Empire is totally given over, this occurs after the fall of the Ptolemies and Seleucids. Verse 4 here is actually a description of moving to the Roman Empire. This is where we differ from most other churches. This is where we differ. Because other churches will now open up charts and everything in chapter 11, and they will start talking about Ptolemaic kings. That's where we get Antiochus Epiphanes and all of these, and that they believe that Antiochus Epiphanes is the little horn, and all of this. This is where they get in the weeds. We were supposed to move past that because the prophecy moves past that. Do you understand what I'm saying? See, chapter 11 says it's scattered to the four winds of heaven, not scattered to the four horns that came up in his place. You with me? In other words, it's given completely over to what? To history. Whew, it's gone. The king of the south will grow strong along with his princes, who will gain ascendancy over him and attain dominion. His domain will be great. A great dominion indeed. See, then they will ascribe, other people will ascribe this to an actual king, a Ptolemaic or Seleucid king, and they'll go on from there. By the time we get to this verse, it's already been given completely over to Rome. And the language and the symbology then completely change. After the Roman Empire, in the zoo of chapter 7 and the statue of chapter 2, after the Roman Empire, who arises up? The little horn. He's next, right? He's next. And as a matter of fact, by the time you get to chapter 8, the Roman Empire, the actual, what we would consider the civil Roman Empire, not the religious Roman Empire that the little horn establishes, that it comes up. It's not the Holy Roman Empire. It's the one that came before. Chapter 8 doesn't even mention it. Just moves on. Because Daniel's not interested in him. He saw him in the zoo. He was, that great beast that he couldn't describe with iron teeth. But when it came to chapter 8, it wasn't that beast he was interested in. It was the little horn. It was that little horn that came up. Daniel then completely brings his interest to him, because that little horn was a religious enemy. That was an enemy of the people of God. That was an enemy of God himself. So by the time we get here, this kingdom of the south, it now becomes symbolic, just as in chapter 8, the language becomes symbolic. But he doesn't use the same symbology. He uses kings and kingdoms. And now all of a sudden, it's this conflict. And like I said, this is where we part from the traditional churches. Because the traditional churches, they're just going to stay in the weeds. and talking about generals and kings and empires from the end of the Greek Empire to the Roman Empire, and then it's going to move to Caesar's and everything else. And by the time that they get done all completely with the Roman Empire, they've run completely out of time. There's no more time for them anymore. We've always looked at this as a spiritual war, as a spiritual enemy. And the king of the north and the king of the south represent where we have already been. The north and the south narrative has nothing to do with the empire remnants of Greece or the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. But it's the spiritual war that the little horn begins to lead in chapter 7 and 8 and all the way down to the feet and the toes in chapter 2. That's what this is concerning. See, the structure of chapter 8 and 11 are the same. Medo-Persia, we just read in verses 3 and 4, in verse 2. In verses 3 and 4 is when it happens in chapter 8. In chapter 8, Greece is verses 5 to 8. In chapter 11, we just read those, verses 3 and 4. Rome is verses 8 and 9. Rome then is in 4. Rome is only mentioned as Greek completely transitioning over. That's where it falls. And then we're down to the little horn. In chapter 8, the little horn comes next, verses 9 through 12. In verses 5 through 39, we're talking about 30 verses are all about the conflicts of the north-south. And the only way that we can make sense of it, the truly only way we can make sense of it, is to liken it to the spiritual war that the little horn started in 457 BC. You with me? 538, sorry. 457, 2300-day prophecy. 538, the 1260-day prophecy that the little horn reigns. That's what the north-south conflict is about. And then the end time, verses 13, 14, 17, and 25, and at the very end of this narrative, verses 40 to 45, is the end time. Y'all get what I'm saying? You get it? See, now you can dive back if you want to. If you want to, you can dive back into verse 5 and just read all through that. And you don't have to worry about signing conflict with conflict here and there and generals and kings and everything. Why? Because this is the spiritual conflict that the little horn brings and reigns upon this planet. 538, 1798. Then another beast, a two-horned beast, continues to go. We've always looked upon the great controversy as not a physical conflict, but a what? A spiritual conflict. It's between these two. And that's why I don't think that we have to get bogged down in trying to assign somebody, some king, some general, some church, somebody, somewhere, some prophecy to this north-south conflict. Because like I said, you got the north fighting with the south, you got the north aligning with the south. You got the north fighting the people of God. You got the north aligning with the people of God. You got the south attacking the people of God. And you got the south aligning with the people of God. All over the place. And if you want to, you can comb through, you know, Greek and Roman history to try to find generals to fit in with each and every one of that conflict. And believe me, when we do, there's something about apocalyptic prophecy. Can you study apocalyptic prophecy without driving yourself insane? Well, the only way you can is to know that God's in charge of all this. And that's where we're at. We have to stay within the place that Daniel has put us. We need to look at where Daniel has put us and know what we're looking at before we even venture in there. So let's review the little horn. In chapter 8, what did he say the little horn would do? What would he be responsible for? It said that he would rise to the heavenly host and even do war against the prince of princes. Remember that? It said that he would desecrate not the earthly sanctuary, but what? The heavenly sanctuary. He would abolish the daily sacrifice. He would grow towards the beautiful land, and eventually he would destroy the holy people. Again, the little horn had complete power over the saints to persecute, to pound, to ground down the saints from 538 to 1798, ending at the French Revolution. And yeah, it was mostly, yes, a Roman Catholic power, but the last 200 years of that prophecy, it was a Protestant power too. Imperial Protestantism. And then after 1798, by the way, when we take it to Revelation and begin to further the timeline, after 1798, there's another beast with two horns that is waiting, that rises up out of the land. He finishes the work. He creates the image of the beast. So remember what the little horn does. So take a look. We'll look at a few of these verses within the north-south conflict and show you. So you remember, he rises to heavenly host and against the prince of princes himself, right? Well, verse 36 in chapter 11. Then the king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every what? Above every god, and speak monstrous things against the God of gods. And he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. He'll show no regard for the gods of his fathers, for the desire of women, nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will what? He will magnify himself above them all. So you see the kingdom, the king of the north? He already is lining himself up with the little horn in chapter 8, isn't he? The little horn said it would desecrate the heavenly sanctuary and abolish the daily sacrifice. In verse 31 of chapter 11, it says, forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation, grow towards the beautiful land. In verse 16, it says, but he who comes against him will do as he pleases. No one will be able to withstand him. He will also stay for a time in the beautiful land with destruction in his hand. He sounds just like the little horn, doesn't he? This king of the north. How many understood and knew before today that in chapter 11, the king of the north was the little horn? We're pretty much the only ones that look at it this way. Like I said, they're looking for another kingdom. They're looking for something north of Babylon. They're looking geographically. They're looking geopolitically. And it doesn't take long to end up completely in the weeds. It said that and it also said it would destroy the holy people. This is what it said in 8:24. His power will be mighty, but not by his own power. He'll destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and what? And the holy people. They both come from the north. The little horn comes from the north. It says in chapter 8, verse 9, out of one of them, out of the four horns that it says, came another horn, a little one which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. The beautiful land is to the west in the prophecy that Daniel is looking at. What's the one place that's left out? Is the north. Why? Because the little horn is already in the north. So they're both, they come from the north. They both came from the north. And they both will, and this one I don't think I don't think it's a stretch. I think we just have to be careful when we read it to understand what he's saying. They both die the same death, the little horn does. The little horn and the king of the north both die the same death. See, at the end of chapter 11, it says he will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to his what? He will come to his end with how many people to help him? No one can help him. Okay? And in 8:25, it says, by his cunning he shall make deceit prosper under his hand, and in his own mind he shall be great. Without warning he'll destroy many and even rise up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken and not by what? And not by human hands. They both die the same death. It was human power that they utilized in order to achieve everything that they achieved. It was political and human power and will that they were able to do it. But in the end, it's a spiritual power. It comes to death not by human hands. And remember, if you want to match these up then to the statue, what brought the feet of clay to the end in the statue was that huge stone that hits human history at the feet and busts it and scatters it to the four winds of heaven, by the way. And then that grows up into an eternal kingdom. It's the second coming that kills the power of the little horn. Not by human hands, but by God. He's the only one that can bring the end to this. So as I said, if you wanted to, go ahead. You can try and go through chapter 11. Match the nearly 2,000-year history of conflicts and wars and kings and Catholics and Protestants and political powers and fights and religious undertones, and you'll end up with the same result, by the way. Nothing but millions of dead, millions of gallons of blood shed, thousands upon millions of martyrs. We'll end up in the same place with no answers. How long, O Lord? Which is not the point of chapter 11. It isn't to tell us how long. It's to tell us who's here. It's to tell us what we are in for. But if you're going to go and do that, I'll leave you this. I'll give you this guide. You can kind of put all the conflicts within categories. This is thanks to Dr. DeCon and his book, Secrets of Daniel. He took all of them and he puts them into conflicts, puts them into categories. You will find conflict between the north and the south representing completely secular worldly kingdoms. Ones that aren't necessarily attached to any particular religion, even though Babylonian kings and Egyptian kings and everything else. And the reason that they picked this is that Egypt becomes kind of the way down there in the south. Okay, but the south ends up in prophecy being these worldly kingdoms that don't necessarily have a religious bent, even though Nebuchadnezzar. Why? Is because the leaders or the kings of those empires actually believed they were gods themselves, didn't they? Nebuchadnezzar believed he was a god himself. So did all the pharaohs. All the Caesars did too, by the way. Then you'll have an alliance between the north and the south when they'll get together. That is the essence of Babylonian worship, is when the two get together. Is when the church begins to use worldly power to try to get people to worship their God. And then you'll have conflict between the north and the people of God. And again, our history is full of this, isn't it? Of those three categories right there. That's what chapter 11 is all about. Bouncing in, bouncing out. So to me, the overall theme is that he changes the language to kings. See, in chapter 10, you have history going on. You have him showing, you have Michael, you have Gabriel showing up saying he was having trouble, you know, fighting, if you will, the king of Persia. So you have secular history going on. You have the statue going on. You're going from Babylon to Medo-Persia, to Greece, to Rome. You have that going on at the same time. And then you have the spiritual part. Remember, Michael shows up and he's dressed like the high priest. Right there, side by side. He puts it together. But in this case, he changes the symbology. He changes it all to kings and kings. Kings and powers and generals and armies and empires. He doesn't change the language. God doesn't show up in a symbolic way here. Why? Because this whole chapter is about the little horn. And the thing about the little horn is that he's completely amalgamated these earthly kingdoms' power, the way that they do what they do to get things done, the way that they ask for their God's worship. He's put it together and nobody can tell the difference between them anymore. That's the point of chapter 11. See, chapter 10, we can go back and God can say, you know what? I showed up as the high priest because I wanted to let you know that you still had heavenly worship going on, that you still had Jesus interceding for you in the heavenly worship, that he was still coming to get you, that the judgment was happening. It was going to be done. In this particular case, as far as history is concerned, beginning with Daniel saying, I'm right here with Darius the Mede, beginning from now until then, this is going to go on side by side, but the little horn is going to usurp, if you will, worldly authority so effectively that you won't be able to tell it apart from people who claim that they are worshiping God. Babylonian worship and Jerusalem worship will look almost the same. We spend so much time using prophecy as a way to dissect the differences. We always need to know the differences. I want to know the difference between the church of the beast and the church of the lamb that was slain, when the problem might be is that they look almost the same. It looks too alike for us to be able to discern false from true. What if the actual danger here is that the two of what we're looking at is the same? This geopolitical, military, civil power coming together with the church, and that it becomes so commonplace that people feel that they can worship this beast and it still feel that they're worshiping Christ. See, the dragon uses both powers. He brings them together in these historical and present and future beasts all the way to the end. The king of the north of the south is this worldly statue in the zoo side by side. You can't tell the difference. They use the same tactics. The world uses the same tactics as the church. The world exercises power over like nobody ever could. The Roman Empire exercised power over as no one can. The superpowers from the Cold War till now, we exercised power over like nobody could. There's nothing wrong with that as long as we recognize that that's how the world operates. The problem is when the church begins to operate that way. You with me? When they bring those two together, that's Babylon. That's the little horn. And I think chapter 11 is telling us, you can't tell the difference between the little horn and the worldly powers. In a way, it doesn't matter who's in the north and who's in the south. Why? Because they're both exercising the same tactics and the same power. They're exercising power over. When the church of the Lamb that was slain actually exercises power where? From under. See, the church of the Lamb that was slain is based on the philosophy that God gave up all of his power in order to die for you and me. Not to will his will or his authority over us, but actually come up from within, plant seeds within us so that the church would act the same way. I think chapter 11, like I said, is telling me that when I see the way the world operates, when I see the way the little horn operates, it's not the differences between the two, because basically there are none. They use the same tactics. They use the same fear and force and coercion. And why? Because it gets results. On this planet, it gets results. The whole world wonders after the beast. Means you and me too. Means on any given day we look and say, you know what, that looks pretty good. Anytime I want revenge on somebody, I'm saying to the beast, you know what, your way of power looks pretty good. Anytime I'm looking for vengeance, anytime I'm looking to will my power, my authority, whatever it is, religious or worldly or whatever, my riches, my military strength, anytime I'm looking to lord that over somebody else, I'm now acting more like the beast than I am the lamb that was slain. See, Babylon is given this whole dragon-based system. See, in Revelation, John hears John is being shown in stages this system in Revelation. He heard of this prostitute. He heard of this great prostitute. In chapter 17, he's finally shown what the prostitute is. Like I said, up until now, he's heard him in a couple of chapters. He's heard of her, if you will. But now he's actually shown her in chapter 17. And this is what she looks like. He says, this is what he saw when he was shown. He carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. Remember the last time that he saw a woman in the wilderness, you know who it was? It was the church. See, because the little horn, or the beast, if you will, or the dragon was persecuting the church, and God protected her by sending her into the wilderness. And when John saw her, remember, she was standing on the moon, she was clothed in the sun, and she had a crown of stars. She was absolute perfect light being protected in the wilderness. Now he's carried back to the wilderness, and he sees a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had 7 heads and 10 horns. The last woman that he saw in the wilderness was who? The church. Now he sees this prostitute. And the reason that he's amazed is why? It's the same woman. There's no other woman in the wilderness to see. She has stepped out of her podium of light, and she's now riding on this scarlet beast. And by the way, the scarlet beast has 10 heads and 7 horns, which means he looks exactly like who? Like the dragon. And by the way, she's riding the beast. Notice the horns don't have any crowns, or the heads don't have any crowns on them, which means who's in charge? Who's in control? She is. The church is. So now, instead of being persecuted, she's doing the persecuting. She's using nations, co-opting them and their power to accomplish this. And John says this. He says she was dressed this way. She was clothed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup of abominations and the impurities of her fornication. And on her forehead was written a name, a mystery. What? Here is the second time that Revelation uses the word what? Babylon, the great mother of whores, of earth's abominations. See, Babylon, impressive power with an impressive ruler, pawning themselves off as a church, as a religious power, if you will. Fear, force, coercion. Daniel and his friends were enlisted as priests by Nebuchadnezzar. He had all the power of the world, and he was forcing them to become his priest. This was a religious and geopolitical power, if you will. And he tries several tactics to get them to worship them. He even threatens to kill them. Babylon's spirit, this harlotry of removing choice in order to worship, religious freedom now becomes the label of the difference between the two. Nebuchadnezzar didn't just defeat Judah and take it captive. He defeated Judah's God. Remember, his last time in, he walked right into the temple. He took the objects of worship and he burned the temple to the ground. That way, when he got back to Babylon, he could look at every Judaic captive and say, I not only defeated you, I defeated your God. It isn't the differences of the power in the end time. It's the sameness. We talk about how much can the church look like the world, how much can the world look like the church. This false church doesn't care how much it looks like of the world. It's co-opted all the power of the world. And it's done it by taking away everyone's freedom. Worship this God or else. To me, this is the way that it is in the end time. This is what chapter 11 is about. Philip Yancey, in his book, Vanishing Grace, may help us just a little bit. Maybe this will open up some things for you. Why is it we seem to care more about people? Why is it that we seem, he's speaking of the church, that we seem to care more that people know what we believe on any particular issue as opposed to caring that other people know we care for them? Today's church, we care more about people knowing that we believe something than we believe in caring for people. Two kings, Herod and Jesus, personified very different kinds of power. Herod had legions of Roman soldiers to enforce his will, and history records how Herod used his power. He stole his brother's wife. He locked up all dissenters. He beheaded John the Baptist as a party trick. Jesus too had power, but he used it compassionately to feed the hungry, to heal the sick. Herod had a gold crown, palaces, guards, and all the visible tokens of royalty. Jesus, the closest thing to a formal coronation or Messiah's anointing, occurred in an embarrassing scene when a disreputable woman poured perfume on his head. He got the title King of the Jews as a criminal sentence. His crown made of thorns were merely one more source of pain. And though he could have called on a legion of angels for protection, he declined. Consistently, Jesus refused to use the coercive power. He knowingly let one of his disciples betray him and then surrendered himself without protest to his captors. It never ceases to amaze me that Christian hope rests on a man whose message was rejected and whose love was spurned, who was condemned as a criminal and given a sentence of death. Later on, he says, when Jesus lived on earth, he made the blind to see and the lame to walk. He'll return to rule over a kingdom that has no disease or disability. On earth, he died and was resurrected. At his return, death will be no more. On earth, he cast out demons, and on his return, he will destroy the evil one. On earth, he came as a baby born in a manger. He'll return as the blazing figure described in the book of Revelation. The kingdom he set in motion on earth was not the end, only the beginning of the end that leads to the beginning that never ends. Anyone, even a half-breed with five husbands or a thief dying on a cross, was welcome to join this kingdom. The person was more important than any category of belief or doctrine. Outsiders regard church people as moralists who want to impose their head beliefs on a diverse society. As philosopher Miroslav Volf noted, when a religion, any religion, tries to force itself on others who do not share its belief, it creates a backlash and stirs up opposition. Evangelicals, the mainstream church in America, led the fight for Americans for women's suffrage and the abolition of slavery. They also fought against both movements. African American pastors, many of them evangelicals, spearheaded the civil rights movement as white evangelicals opposed it. In the 1980s, Jerry Falwell urged American Christians to buy gold Krugerrands and to promote U.S. investment in South Africa in an effort to shore up the apartheid regime. Currently, evangelicals take a prominent role in supporting pro-life legislation, but also championing the death penalty, gun rights, and military ventures. Do we believe that just nobody notices the discord? John says that the woman was clothed in scarlet and purple. We go back to our scripture reading. Soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and put a purple robe on him. Jesus then came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." The same story in Matthew says that the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters. They gathered the whole cohort around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. After twisting some thorns into a crown, they put it on his head. They put a reed in his hand and knelt before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." Here's what we're getting at. He was mocked for not being the king that everyone wanted him to be. He was mocked for not taking power as the world takes power and lording it over people to get what he wants. He was mocked for it. He was mocked for the love that makes him appear weak, and they threw a robe on him to cover it up. And then to prove how weak he was, they take him out to the people that he was meant to save, and they ask for a thief's life or an insurrectionist's life rather than his. The American church is satisfied with a lamb-like beast. The American church, we seem to be satisfied with a part-time lamb. The American church wants a lamb who, when it gets to that neighbor that you can't love, then you get to act like the beast. Who wouldn't want a job, a God like that? The American church is satisfied with the lamb holding off when I need to carry out something else that requires my vengeance and my revenge. True Christians settle nothing for nothing less than the full-time lamb. To me, that's what Daniel 11 is about. Daniel's saying, look, I've spent this all these years, almost my entire adult life now, looking at these prophecies and everything else. And on my way out, I want to let you know that what I noticed, what I see, that what we'll be living with from here on out are two churches vying for worship for two different gods. And you'll have a worldly power and this false church, and you won't be able to tell the difference between the two. And you probably shouldn't even waste time trying. And what we should do is what Jesus was mocked for. To love how many people? Everybody. And to welcome them into the kingdom prepared before the foundation of the world. So if we do, just a warning, if he was mocked for it, guess who'll be mocked for it? And where will the mocking be coming from? From the world? No, in fact, the world admires us when we do what Jesus does, when we do what he asks to be done. The world actually admires us for that. You know where we get the garbage from? We get it from those who claim to be a church in the church of Jesus Christ. So, I'm ready to be mocked. How about you? And when they do mock me, I'm coming to you for comfort. You're my church, okay? And when they do mock you, you can come back here, all right? Because you won't get it here. If you've decided to love as much as Christ has loved you, you will not get mocked here. And bring those people that you love, that the church threw away a long time ago, and let them mock, and let them line up with the world. Here, we'll celebrate the kingdom. So, thanks for going through the weeds for me. If you want to go back into the weeds, go right ahead. Just take these guidelines with you and remember what maybe it isn't what Daniel wanted us completely to know, but for me right now, it's just, I don't know, looking around us, I see this being fulfilled before us every day. And we need to make sure that our doors are open. We need to make sure that this place is safe. We need to make sure that no one would miss the grace of God. So, we will do 12. Okay, we'll go one more chapter. In fact, I think chapter 12 is not quite as weedy as this one is, but we will do it. We are going to finish. I promise you that I would. But thank you all. Thank you for gathering in the weeds with me.